Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Van Maren Show. My name is Jonathan Van Maren, and my interview today is with a father who has been through one of the worst possible things a father can endure. This story was broken a couple of years ago by Abigail Schreier. She published an article in 2022 titled, "How a Dad Lost Custody of His Son After Questioning His Transgender Identity." That was in the New York Post. And it's the story of Ted Hudako and his wife, Christine, who underwent a fairly acrimonious split. And afterwards, his wife went and got his son sterilized without his consent, despite multiple court orders that were supposed to ensure that this would not take place. This happened in California, and the story of one parent seeking to transition a child while the other stands helplessly by, in almost all cases, it's the mother attempting to transition the child while the father stands helplessly by, are becoming more and more common. I covered Ted's story a couple of years ago when it first came out, or I covered some of the court proceedings, and I've covered other stories like it. And Ted has agreed to come on the program along with his attorney. And it's a story that is very difficult to hear in a lot of ways, but a story that I think that we do need to hear, because the story that he and his attorney, Tracy Henderson, are conveying here is one that should shock everybody very, very deeply, but should also wake people up to the implications of the gender ideology we are implementing into law and into family law specifically. And so I don't want to get into too many of the details just because it's a long conversation. We get into the details then. So without further introduction from me, here is my conversation with Ted Hudako and his attorney, Tracy Henderson, who is representing him. All right, Ted, just to start off, maybe let's back up to the beginning of the story and take our listeners through what took place. So when did your family ordeal that's now been covered in a whole slew of national newspapers begin?
In 2019, after I'd been married nearly 20 years in a marriage with two sons who at the time were 15 and 13, shortly after the older one turned 15, his mother came to me and abruptly told me that he was trans. And it was shocking news. And she immediately, as in the same night, separated from the marriage. And she took both our sons with her. The younger one, the 13-year-old, returned home a few days later. My now ex-wife, it apparently had some degree of planning to this and went to live initially with a neighbor in the neighborhood with a very large home. She asked to begin our son in therapy, which I agreed to without doing any vetting or diligence on the therapist, unfortunately, in retrospect. She ended up filing, and if I didn't mention it, the younger son came home back to the house with me just a few days later. Meanwhile, his brother and mother continued living separately, and she filed for divorce about 4 months later at the very end of 2019. As you know, in 2020, COVID-19 began and lockdowns began, especially in California, including the courts, which slowed things down. We eventually got into the family court in June of 2020. I had the unfortunate luck of the draw to get assigned Joni Hiramoto as my judge, who failed to disclose her preconceived biases or prejudices about gender transition, as well as failing to disclose that she had an adult son who had transitioned just previously to presiding over my case, who transitioned male to female.
Now, 2019, this is about 5 years after the transgender movement went from sort of the fringe of the LGBT movement to really mainstream after that Time magazine cover with Laverne Cox that says the transgender tipping point. And I remember this very clearly because in 2016, when my first book, The Culture War, was published, I had a chapter on the LGBT movement, but there was only three paragraphs on the trans aspect of the movement, because I was just kind of saying, what is this? This is what, how it's not the same thing as being a transvestite. Here's what it was very explanatory. Well, in the couple of years after the book was published, it went from the dominating cultural issue in the United States and across the Western world. So when the scenario you just described happened to you, what was your knowledge or awareness of what the transgender movement and transgenderism was all about at that point?
Well, my ex-wife subscribed to, I believe, Vanity Fair magazine, you know, one of those glossy color lifestyle magazines. And I feel like in that time period, every other month was the cover photo was, here's Angelina Jolie. Look how stunning and brave she is for transitioning her child. Or the next month, here's Charlize Theron doing the same thing. Or here's Caitlyn Jenner. Look how stunning and brave she is. So it seemed like there was sort of a constant steady drumbeat of that, at least in some of the popular culture. I was even noticing it back then. I will also say, and I don't know if I've said this publicly before, you know, in the few years before my wife suddenly announced our son was trans, I had a fairly lengthy commute to my job for a large tech company in Silicon Valley, which took a bit of my time. And part of that commute, I'd catch up on the news of the day on the train ride. And I do recall reading about the custody case in Texas involving Jeff Younger. And I recall also coming home and sitting at the dinner table and saying, hey, honey, have you heard about this crazy custody case down in Texas where the mom, the ex-partner, is wanting to gender transition, the 7-year-old son? Isn't that the craziest thing ever? And I think my expectation would be that she'd say, yeah, that's really messed up. But that's not the response I got from her. She actually was silent. And it was, I in retrospect, think she just was tucking that fact away. And I believe she used this as a tactic in her divorce. I think that was at least one motivation.
Now, in the lead up to this, I know that you've said before in both podcast interviews and to media that you were completely stunned. Was there any indication, as far as you were concerned, that your son identified as transgender, identified as female?
I would say no. Now, in 2018, there was a family tragedy involving my ex-wife's sister. That couple, the sister-in-law, went through a marital separation, and there were accusations of domestic violence, and there was actually an attempted murder by the ex-husband. My former sister-in-law in 2018 was stabbed more than 20 times and nearly died. Went through, you know, some critical surgeries, was in ICU for a period of time. My ex-wife appropriately spent several months with her between 2018 and 2019, assisting her sister in the physical recovery from her injuries, as well as assisting her through the two legal processes of the criminal prosecution of the former husband, as well as a civil process of revisiting the marital settlement arrangement, which I guess everything got reset to zero because of the crime. One thing that did happen in the sentencing phase of that criminal action is that my ex-wife insisted that our sons be present with her in New York State, where this took place. I don't know if my boys were in the courtroom, but they certainly were in the homes of the in-laws and were privy to those conversations. And that sentencing phase, and that happened exactly 1 month before the announcement of trans identity, allegedly, of my son. Now, I have been in a number of support groups of parents who've had the transgender fairy visit their family. Fortunately, most of those families, the couples, find ways to work together and you know, try to make the best and to support their child through this struggle or this situation. In about 4.5% of the cases, there tends to be or is a fracture in the relationship, as was the case in mine. But what's interesting, there's a pretty interesting gamut of parents and families that are in this. Many who are professionals, you know, very educated professionals. And I've had more than one or two make the observation, Ted, it's not that difficult to understand what happened. If your son thought that by growing up and becoming a man and seeing the example of his uncle violently attacking his wife, why wouldn't he want to opt out of being a man?
That was posited by a counselor in the recent documentary Lost Boys by Jennifer Lull as well. Those kinds of examples can be one thing that leads to trans identification. Do you have any idea who introduced him to the idea that he could identify as a different gender in the first place?
Well, we're getting into a lot of speculation here. I'll also say that in the years before the transgender identification, you know, there seemed to be some divergence in I guess approaches to cultural issues between myself and my ex-wife. I had mentioned Vanity Fair magazine and you know that it's a preoccupation with the subject back then, and promotion seemingly of the subject back then. I do recall when our son was 11. That my ex-wife became insistent that he have a cell phone. And I said, he doesn't need a cell phone. And he'll have access to a lot of materials that even with the available parental controls, we won't be able to monitor. It's completely inappropriate. Why does he need a cell phone? And her answer was, I need to know where he is. I said, you know where he is. He's at school. And when he's not in school, he's at after school daycare or he's with us. Maybe he's doing sports. Maybe with where that I would be coaching, or maybe he's at music lessons and we know his instructor. He doesn't need a cell phone. And the compromise that I thought we worked out would be that I would get him an iPad, and I got him a very nice iPad, which he would only be able to use on Wi-Fi. And it was so large, it was the large model, that wouldn't be portable really to carry around all the time. And I thought that would be a workable solution. So he'd have a device of his own that he could use that would have some ability to monitor. And a few weeks after that, his mother bought him the cell phone anyway, without my knowledge.
So backing up to the origin of the story here, your wife announces to you that your son is actually a girl, is transgender, moves out. Did you have any conversations with your son at any point?
There was a letter that was sent, maybe a less than one page, maybe a half page letter on relatively large font, two paragraphs, which strikingly is curious to template letters that many parents receive. I didn't think that all the words in that were his. So there was that. I mentioned that therapy with an LMFT, a licensed marriage and family therapist, was begun about a week or so after the announcement and separation. And I naively told my wife, sure, let's begin him on therapy. Why not? Big mistake. I certainly should have vetted this individual. I should have met with him first and discovered what his values and approach were, as well as, you know, his degree of training, which I don't think was necessarily that complete. He had changed careers late in life to the LMFT profession. But I also later discovered, and I think my ex-wife described him as having some experience in this area, presumably trans, which I subsequently came to learn that meant being part of the pipeline to put the kids onto the gender clinic treadmill or a conveyor belt at UCSF, University of California, San Francisco.
So in the accounts that you've shared publicly so far, you know, so you agreed to therapy. Your wife is separated, just, I guess, assuming that that you're not going to be supportive of what her plans are. And you started to do a whole bunch of research into what was going on. What did you look at? What did you find? What kind of sources did you track down?
Yeah, in 2019, there was not a lot. There was a website, I think, called Transgender Trend, which was UK-based, if I recall correctly.
Yep.
There was also another one called Fourth Wave Now.
Yep.
And if you looked hard enough, you could find accounts in particular about parents in the San Francisco Bay Area who had engaged their children with UCSF. And even back in 2019, there were concerns that every kid, it was the Roach Motel. The kids check in, they never check out. If your kid encountered UCSF, they would put your child on puberty blockers, which seemed kind of curious. And I did some more looking, and then I discovered that UCSF, Dr. Stephen Rosenthal, MD, who's their director of their Child Adolescent Gender Center and named as a principal investigator on a grant program sponsored by National Institutes of Health to study puberty blockers, that they had this study underway, along with three other hospitals in the United States. So that seemed interesting to me because something I read about that grant program, they needed 400 subjects for their puberty blocker studies. And it's like, well, that's certainly going to drive or motivate them to rope in as many subjects as possible. So I had concerns about that. The limited conversations my ex and I had, some of this was over text, was her continuing interest to engage with UCSF. I did actually speak to some professionals there. One name in particular that comes up is Ben Morsa, who I think is a psychologist on the adult side. But I had a phone conversation with him on a Thursday afternoon. I remember it quite well. And he was trying to persuade me that our family should engage with UCSF. And I had questions specifically about the assessment process that they did. I was blunt with him. I said, you know, I've read that your organization puts everyone on puberty blockers. I said, what are you going to look at in my son? I mean, are you going to run a neuropsychological battery of tests on him? Is there some testing that you can do to see if he's on the ASD or autism spectrum? And I also I asked him, where would you assess where he is on the Blanchard typology? And that I meant the Ray Blanchard typology of male transsexuals, you know, which Blanchard postulated that there were four different types. And I suppose if you simplify it, maybe two, you know, primary types of male transsexuals or transgenders, if you prefer the term, one being the HSTS, homosexual transsexual, or the AGP, the autogonophile, and that their psychological profiles and motivations are very different, so that it seemed to me, even as a layperson, that you'd really want to see where the individual lies on that spectrum, or at least see they fit in the model, and then from there figure out the therapy, not just apply the same therapy to everyone. And this Ben Morsa got agitated with me. He said, "We don't use Blanchard." And I was just stunned. I said, "Why? Is there a different model? Is there a better model? Let me tell me. I'm curious." And he just got angrier at me. And I had been on the phone with him for more than an hour at that point, so I ended the call. But that to me didn't inspire any confidence in UCSF, and it actually made me more concerned.
UCSF, for listeners who don't know, is what?
University of California, San Francisco.
So you do this research and then you tell your wife that you're opposed to transition. Walk us through that timeline. What happened?
That's overstating the case. Okay. So you said opposed. Don't paint me with that label. I'm not an extremist. Okay. If I may take a position, but I'm very open-minded. Okay. If compelling evidence comes along that is persuasive and evidence-based and data-based, I'm absolutely going to change my mind. Okay. But I'm not going to just, fall for an illogical argument. That's quite different. I really take exception to that opposed, because you're using the language that the family court uses. And that's effectively, if you are a parent like me who has questions or wants to take a slower approach, a watchful waiting approach, which previously was the approach that this profession applied to this special population, the family court labels a parent like me as the parent in opposition. And that becomes a default basis to deny or strip custody. And it's not, I'm not opposed to anything. I'm actually I'm for data and evidence and logic. And preserving the health of, I'm sorry, preserving the health of my son.
Mm-hmm. I have to jump in here though. The law is very clear, excuse me, in some of this regard. For example, in this particular case, there's a family code that it makes it a violation of the law to sterilize a child. There are several federal court statutes that make some of this medical mutilation steps child abuse. So frankly, from a legal perspective, I take a different position than Ted. Medical mutilation should be a crime. In federal law, it is a crime, and we have a serious problem here, because in California, for example, they're trying to create a social norm that gender affirming care is good for a child. They tried to pass a law that made a court consider that in a custody situation, for example, which would seriously impact Ted, that it would be one of the factors that a court would weigh in terms of determining best interest in custody of a child. And that is a very, very, very dangerous thing that is happening in California, again, to make gender-affirming care a social norm. Because the truth is, if a child, and I don't care what adults do in their own private time, I'm not talking about adults, that's your life, I'm talking about children who are under the age of 18, if a child starts playing this game of questioning their gender, use of pronouns, I want to use a different bathroom, which personally I think is a fad, they have potentially a DSM-5 mental condition and need therapy. And the other challenge is that in California, the medical profession, especially psychotherapists, are being taken over by whatever language you want to use, woke, ideology, whatever language you choose, they're being pushed to create, again, a social norm that gender affirmation care is good. And from a legal perspective, it is not in the best interest of a child whatsoever. They need a therapist that figures out why they're confused about what it is that's going on with them.
Okay, thanks for that, Tracy. To pick up the thread here then, Ted, so you were advocating for a watchful waiting approach to this. And so how does the timeline proceed from there?
Just to drive home the point, I did engage, consult with Kenneth Zucker, Blanchard's student and colleague.
Yeah, he's Canadian.
From Toronto. Yeah, and I actually wanted Zucker to be involved in the assessment of my son. So we had the first custody hearing in June of 2020. That was reported on relatively extensively by Abigail Schreier. The transcript is exactly as Schreier described it. I was posed with the hypothetical of whether I'd support my son if he had the identity of Queen of England. I pointed out that was, an illogical impossibility to the judge, which seemingly just enraged her. It didn't matter. None of that mattered. She had.
So I remember reading that transcript. For the listeners who didn't, Schreier's reporting on this almost defied belief. Can you recount for us that Queen of England bit? Because I'd like to emphasize for those listeners, like, this is a real thing that happened.
Right. So Judge Hiramoto, who, by the way, her hair literally was blue. She dyes her hair blue.
Shocking. The least shocking detail of the story, actually. But yes.
Yeah, I mean, asked me if Mr. Hudako, if your son were to believe himself to be the Queen of England, would you love him? And I said, well, of course I would, but I'd also try to get him help. And she said, well, be that as it may, if your son's psychologist told you that telling him or confronting him that he's not the Queen of England would be bad for his mental state, you know, could you go along? And I said, well, I situationally affirm that to him, to stabilize the situation. But in reality, he is not the Queen of England, and that's not going to change. And even the therapist would know that. The subtext being that, you know, that would be an absurd thing that actually should be a basis for the therapist to be fired and a therapist grounded in reality brought in. Just like what should have happened is that a judge grounded in reality should have been brought in. But that's not the case. It just, and again, I was very polite. I had decorum for the court. I mean, I describe it, you know, with a different tone than I took.
I read the transcript.
Yeah.
And so, what were next steps? You have this bizarre courtroom hearing with a judge that I want to remind the listeners. You mentioned this already, and this was in Schreier's coverage. Had a trans-identified child herself, and obviously had a huge bias in a very specific direction, and had specific ideological views that impacted her judgment. Where did it go from there?
Judge Hiramoto said that she had a minors counsel in mind who had special training in the area, without specifying exactly what his special training was. That was Daniel Harkins, who has served as the president of the Minors Counsel Family Law Society in my county, Contra Costa, for a number of years. He's been appointed minors counsel more than 50 times, according to his own biography, obviously well known in the family court community. We were ordered to pay him, I think it was around $400 an hour. The majority of that was assessed to me. So that one thing that actually meant is anytime I did anything in court, I was carrying the load of this guy, this court appointed attorney, ostensibly for both my sons, but in reality, he was just a lick spittle of a Judge Hiramoto and another legal opponent. He was ordered to write a report. He did a cursory interview separately with each of the family members. Spoke on more than, I believe, two occasions. If you actually look at his bill, he spent the majority of his time communicating and billing me for his time, communicating with Diane Ehrensaft of UCSF. That's the psychologist who believes that an 18-year-old can know its gender, and that we should listen to our child, to our 18-year-old, and if we don't, we're bad parents.
18, do you mean 18-month-old?
18-month-old, I'm sorry, 18-month-old.
This is the one who said that if the onesie is unsnapped,
yes,
consistently, that could the tiny child could be alerting the parents to the fact that he wants a dress and thus is a girl, yes?
Yes, that's one of the many strange things that Diane Ehrensaft have said over the years.
So when did we get to the point where the battle over transition began?
Well, in the June hearing that I mentioned, Judge Hiramoto named UCSF. She also stated that none of the providers I had suggested, including Ken Zucker, would be allowed to participate or have contact with my son. The Minors Council report was issued just excoriating every aspect of my parent, at least with respect to my older son. He said things like, you know, the dad needs to realize that his son is an independent person at 16 and needs to make some decisions for himself. I guess, including sex change. UCSF was and basically that minors council report. He had a statutory time requirement to provide it to us. He didn't meet the time requirement. He gave it to us, I think, maybe a day or two before the hearing. Nonetheless, we were able to read it. I read it. I wrote a rebuttal response to that, which my attorney at the time filed. Refuted pretty much every point that the Miners Council had made. And I introduced more information. In particular, I had come across a paper by Dr. Rosenthal and some other associates, Dr. Rosenthal being the other medical director at UCSF, that described their technique and what they thought were important. They don't think that doing mental cognitive assessment is important over there. But curiously, in the bibliography, they included a reference to a brain study by author Schneider and some other authors originating from a hospital in Brazil, which discusses in great alarm the impact to the brain development by puberty blockers, including in that case a drop in IQ of 9 points, which, depending on where it is on the scale, so it's a part of the IQ scale is logarithmic, that I actually might be a halving of IQ in some regards. And I presented that in my rebuttal, brought it up during the hearing, and Miners Counsel Harkin's only answer to that was to go, "The Brazil report." He basically resorted to name calling. No argument whatsoever. But again, it didn't matter. Nothing mattered. The judge Hiramoto had preconceived orders. He had pre-written orders in both the June hearing and the August hearing of 2020. Now, I mentioned that when Judge Hiramoto had appointed Dan Harkins at the first hearing, that she claimed he had special training. Well, it seems likely that the special training Judge Hiramoto was referring to for Mr. Harkins was a continuing legal education class in transgender and custody issues, because of a course of exactly that name was presented by Judge Hiramoto and a gentleman by the name of Asaf Orr, who was the legal director of UCSF's Child Adolescent Gender Center. And Mr. Orr also wore the hat of senior counsel for the Transgender Youth Project, housed in the National Center for Lesbian Rights. We have obtained the 2021 edition of that class, in which Asaf Orr point blank says puberty blockers are fully reversible, 100% reversible. No side effects, no harm, no harms whatsoever. It's a pause button. None of which is true.
Yeah, it's all garbage.
This class, and it's a class intended for minors councils, people just like Mr. Harkins. It's a required class, in fact, for people who want to do that line of work or to retain their accreditation to keep doing that line of work. In the 2021 version of that class, they presented artifacts from my case, including the Miners Council report, and praised Mr. Harkin's work as demonstrating exactly how to rebut the parent in opposition. Again, a parent like myself who has questions about the efficacy and safety, about these treatments.
So I want to interject one question here before we discuss the what your wife did to have your son transitioned, essentially, which is that a lot of people listening are going to have one really big question. And that's, as we discussed at the beginning of this conversation, This is a pretty new phenomenon, relatively speaking. In 2019, when you start looking around for information, you know, on gender dysphoria and what the best approach is, there's not a lot out there. And I recognize both of the websites that you named, because those were two of the only websites you could go to find parental testimonies, almost all of them anonymous for fear of being, you know, persecuted or prosecuted. Now you've got resources like Parents with Inconvenient Truths About Trans, where a lot of the names are still anonymous, but there's thousands of stories from parents like yourself describing their situation. So now it's a little bit more accessible. But how do you have a situation where, without the majority of people being at all aware of what's going on, you have almost the entire legal institutions kind of pivot?
And the corporate HR apparatus and DEI apparatus, absolutely, as well. If you're an
historically speaking, in historical terms, overnight, this happened unbelievably fast. That suddenly, you know, you've got judges, you've got this whole infrastructure that you just described, a sort of web of different people, all of whom are working against you, having labeled you the parent in opposition to ensure that you essentially have no say in what happens to your child, even if that can be permanent and irreversible damage. It's one thing to say this ideology caught on and it was a peer contagion, as Dr. Lisa Littman says, or it's something that spread via social media, kids getting cell phones. It's quite another thing when a parent is essentially getting stonewalled by the institutions of his society that he could once rely on. How did that happen?
How did it happen? I mean, well, maybe you'd want to back up and say, I mean, if this were all just happenstance and accidents, right, and there was some randomness, you would think that one single thing would actually fall on the side of favor for the parent in opposition. Mm-hmm. Yep. But that's not what happens, okay? At least not in my case. I mean, maybe I broke a bunch of mirrors some time back, and going through that stretch, it's been a challenge. But I guess, you know, we just have to accept our challenges and try to muddle through. How did this happen? Well, who benefits from all this? That might be one way to look at this. And again, this is speculation. Just because I'm speculating doesn't mean it's true. So people can do their own math. But one thing that happens is, well, families get destroyed, or certainly severely stressed. And without families, individuals, if children become atomized individuals without the natural support net that their families otherwise would have provided, which makes them prey to becoming dependent on the government. So the government, you know, again, you could say, well, they're people who are, there's a larger audience of people who are now dependent on government services. So all of the bureaucracies of the government that might be involved in this, whether or not you agree they deliver services efficiently or not, they stand to benefit. Certainly the pharma companies stand to benefit. Providers stand to benefit. Dr. Rosenthal over at UCSF and his colleagues, I mean, Dr. Rosenthal, we know, has accepted thousands, tens of thousands of dollars from pharma companies. I'll name Endo, I'll name AbbVie. That's you know, been published in Breitbart and elsewhere, both individually as a doctor, as well as in his former role as president, I believe it was Pediatric Endocrine Society, or maybe the Endocrine Society itself. And of course, he's accepted roughly $1 million a year from the National Institutes of Health annually since, I think, 2015 on the behalf of UCSF for his puberty blocker study at UCSF. You know, if he's able to get enough data and fudge the results and pass this by a captured FDA and get approval for this category of drug for a new use in this population, well, then he'll certainly have the notoriety or fame, maybe in his eyes. Certainly there's some financial benefit to all this. That he benefits the clinics, the hundreds of clinics around the country benefit. You know, there's just figure out who benefits from this.
Yeah, follow the money. Yeah. So you discussed this court case. Now, how did we get from there to here. So what ends up happening is that against your wishes, against all the research that you presented and against the law, as has been expressed, and we'll get Tracy to your insights on that in a moment. What ended up actually unfolding despite your objections?
Well, I told you about the August hearing, and
yep.
You know, one of the problems I experienced in 2019 was there wasn't much awareness of this in the legal profession. The attorneys who did have some, I guess, interest or awareness of this seemed to conflate being transgender with just being gay or a special kind of gay. My attorney at the time didn't seem to understand that you don't get it, Nate. If he gets put on the conveyor belt at UCSF, they are going to puberty block him and he will get sterilized. And his mother either can't discern this or she's using this as a tactic. And he simply didn't believe that. In my ex-wife's defense, maybe she had white lab coat syndrome where she just simply was dazzled and awed by, you know, these luminous doctors and psychologists like Diane Aarons have. Maybe they seem like charlatans and frauds to me, but maybe I'm just more critical. I attempted to change the custody orders. I dismissed my original attorney with the intention to retain a different attorney. But the same day that the substitution out of my first attorney, the minors counsel filed an adverse emergency motion against me. And I had 24 hours to respond to that, which at the time it wasn't represented. I did file a response. And I not only that, I filed a counter motion. We had a hearing in November of 2020. I attempted to introduce more evidence. I made the court take judicial notice of federal legislation that had been introduced to ban puberty blockers and these transition surgeries or treatments on children, as well as take judicial notice of the Kirabel UK ruling. None of this was persuasive to Judge Hiramoto. She wasn't having any of it. I had tried again in a month later at another hearing to bring in two expert witnesses, including an MD endocrinologist, as well as a clinical child psychologist. Again, and Judge Hiramoto refused to let a doctor and a psychologist testify. There was no help for me. I got badly beaten up. In court. Actually, very interesting about that December hearing is that the Judge Hiramoto did what's known as cleansing the record. So when I ordered the transcript for that hearing of December 2020, the first 30 minutes of argumentation over whether my expert witnesses could appear vanished.
Hmm.
It's not in the record. It's all gone. And there are other entries from the docket that have disappeared as well.
Unbelievable. When did the transition take place?
Well, I one thing about the August 2020 order is that while Judge Hiramoto stripped all custody and visitation with my older son, again, but granting me shared equal physical and legal custody of our younger son, I was denied participation in medical appointments. I was denied ability to read records. Actually, technically, I was allowed to see the records, but UCSF made it impossible for me to see the records. That August 2020 order included what we call the no surgery injunction. And it stated that the minor child shall not undergo any gender identity related surgery without the written consent of both parents or an express order of this court. So while I couldn't see my son, I did at least naively think that he was safe. But that was not the case. So October of 2021, on a weekend, I was reviewing my postal mail, opening my mail. I had a very thick envelope from my health provider, United Healthcare. I'll also mention, I don't think I've said this publicly before, United Healthcare and my employer, the large tech company, had a written employee policy on transgender health and gender transition. Page 14 of this document outlines the requirements for gender surgery. Requirement number 3 was must be 18 years of age. So I also thought that my health insurance and my employer had a written policy that would prevent what happened. So what I ended up discovering when I was going through my mail, looking at my insurance statement, there was a $209,820.34 charge dated August 4th of that year. It just simply said the date and the name of the doctor, and I knew it was from UCSF. It did not say what the service was. I sent an email to my ex-wife and her attorney and asked what could account for a $209,820.34 charge. I had asked twice. She eventually replied and said, our son underwent a little procedure. I didn't want to tell you because of how I thought you'd react. He had a Suprelin implant. I didn't know what Suprelin was at the time, so that became another little research project to discover what Suprelin is. It's a device that is surgically implanted under the skin, you know, in the arm typically. The surgical prescribing information, or the prescribing information describes exactly as is a surgical procedure. Here is the prescribing pack. Includes a scalpel, uses sutures to, it makes an incision. Words obviously very descriptive of a surgery. The ex-wife's attorney about a month later sent me another bill for about $745 on the same date, and that bill says surgery in all capital letters. Same event, same treatment. So at that point, I knew for certain that a surgery had been performed in violation of orders, and I attempted to file a motion for removal of the implant. At that point, the minor's counsel filed an opposition, as did my ex-wife. They both filed oppositions. The minor's counsel persuaded the presiding judge that there was no expedient emergency, that the matter did not need to be heard on an expedited basis, which I thought it did, because according to the experts I had consulted, my son would be permanently sterilized in 4 months from August of 2021, that is. Basically, he probably was sterilized in December of 2021 by the combination of Suprelin and estrogen, which had been started. The judge at the time set hearing for May the following year. In just 3 weeks before my son would turn 18 and age out of the system. The judge in the matter off the record told me that even had I proceeded with that motion, he probably would have ruled against me. And he said, even if you do win, I'm not going to order that device removed.
So obviously your son is a lot older now. He's, as you say, aged out of the system. But you're still fighting in court. What's the current status of the legal proceedings?
So in terms of current status of the legal proceedings, right now there is a contempt hearing matter proceeding in the family court against Harkins, the ex-wife, and Bigger, Nathaniel Bigger. And we tried to have UCSF held to answer for contempt, but the court erroneously said that it did not have jurisdiction over a non-party, which is not true. So we filed a writ on that issue, And the appellate court came back and said, we will revisit that issue with you after the contempt matters against the other three are concluded, which actually makes no sense. It was a little concerning, but that's where we are with that. So we have a hearing on May 3rd in that matter. It's basically a motion hearing. It's not the actual contempt trial, because they've filed documents to attack the contempt allegations. In the federal court right now, we have motions to dismiss, and I forget when they're scheduled for, but they're not, I think not until May again. So the oppositions have filed motions to dismiss the federal matter.
Okay. Ted, what has this been like for you personally? You're very composed. And you're very factual, and you're really good at laying out the story, but like, this must have been hell for you.
Yeah, it's been quite an ordeal. It impacted my health negatively. Don't want to get too much into that. It impacted me professionally. I did not get any help from the large tech company. In fact, that large, much like Vanity Fair, the large company internal newsletter, seemingly every other issue had a featurette of some employee who either was transitioning themselves or transitioning their child, and how stunning and brave they were and how grateful they were to the company for the support that they were getting. The internal company resources were entirely based on gender affirmative care. And in particular, Dr. Tandy I of Stanford's gender clinic gave invited seminars to employees to how to shepherd their kids through transition and to avail themselves of the services provided at Stanford. Again, everything was geared entirely towards medicalizing one's children. I attempted to share, at the time we were starting to see a little bit of traction on the gender critical side, Advocates Protecting Children or Partners for Ethical Care before that. They had some publications. I believe SEGM had some publications. And I attempted to share that with the Human Resources Department. And that just went nowhere. They were not interested in that. And I actually mentioned, well, when I learned about the surgery for the suprelin implant, in that phase when I was seeking information, I went on to an internal company chat channel, not a work-related channel, but a voluntary interest group channel, which was Trans Kids Parenting. And I asked if anyone had experience with that drug, and also mentioned that the limited information I'd found was that it was in the category of drugs that is used to chemically castrate convicted sex offenders. And that's entirely factual. I wasn't saying it to be inflammatory. I was saying it, asking, has anybody got experience in this Trans Kid Parenting channel? Has anybody experience with this? What should I expect? And I didn't get the kind of support that one would hope for. In fact, I got attacked by adult individuals who I believe are trans themselves or trans identifying, who don't have children. What they were doing on a parenting channel, I don't quite understand, but that's what ended up happening. So that was an interesting challenge in addition to the other challenges that I was undergoing. And same tech company, very much platforms this agenda, not only, in the internal company newsletter, but also in content it creates and promotes on its own distribution networks. The CEO even famously platformed a famous former sports star who has promoted transition of his son against the wishes of the ex-wife. So, you know, it's been an interesting experience. And like I said, that my former employer, as well as my former insurance company, have a written policy against gender surgeries on minors. Yet they authorized a $209,000 procedure on my son when he was 17. So it's been a rather surreal experience. It's been an interesting exercise in developing resilience, and I hope everybody in this should just take things one day at a time and live to fight another day. Look at it that way. Find something to rely on. I won't get into proselytizing or preaching.
Can I ask you where your son is now?
He's probably about 3 miles away. He's lives with his mother. He did take and I use he. Okay, I suppose that's politically incorrect and insensitive to some of the audience, but that's who he is to me. He's never explained this to me or his pronouns or new name. I would like to have that conversation with him someday. I would have liked to have had conversations with him a few years ago. And I actually just want to go back because early in this, you know, I always thought he and I could sit down and I thought we could have, he and I could have a conversation. And this would not have been a short or even necessarily a one sitting conversation, but it really would have been, well, how did you come to this conclusion? How, you know, walk me through this. And I think I had a couple hundred questions, you know, it was a Socratic dialogue, to kind of suss out where he was. And to be honest with you, the way I thought about this conversation with him, there actually was a possible pathway, depending on how those questions were answered and where his responses were, that I might actually, there actually was a way that I could have actually, at the end of that, said, you know what? He really well and truly has thought this all out, and he's covered all the bases, and I have to agree with him that this is right. And now I put the actual probability of that outcome at less than 5%, but it's still more than zero. But we never had that opportunity to have that conversation, in my opinion, very much to his detriment, and that was all by design, by the therapists, by the gender clinic, by the family court officials, by the school counselors, and that is happening not just only to my child. It's happening to a lot of families. We in one of my parents' groups, we just had a child who had transitioned and then detransitioned. And unalived himself recently. So, you know, I'm not unique. I just happened to talk about it. And, you know, I guess why I talk about it, why I went public. I didn't get the support from, you know, my employer who I'd spent a pretty happy, I thought, 7 years with, and instead got witch hunted out of there. And what the family court was doing to me, I just kind of felt like everything was coming down on me like a ton of bricks. And like, what else do I have to lose? You know, why not talk about this? And so that's why I put my head above the parapet, I guess.
Tracy, where do you hope these legal proceedings end up? What kind of impact do you hope that this ongoing fight will have?
So I'm a licensed attorney, and my job is to zealously represent my client, and Ted is my client. So what I hope is that Ted is made whole for what he's gone through. Now, you have to understand that this group of people are ideologically, I can't even say that word, are pushing an ideology that is harmful to children. And as Ted articulated, it's happening across the nation. So this case, just for existing, has implications because they're brand new. We're just seeing these kinds of cases come into the court system. But from my perspective, this woman took their son and had him surgically implant a $209,000 puberty blocker, knowing this child was going to be sterilized. And I just ask you and your viewers, you know, Jonathan, as a man, to put yourself in his position. What do you think he's going through? So he has the right to be made whole monetarily. And I can tell you, you can hear it in his voice. You can hear it in his story. He's doing this for more than just himself. But from my perspective, my job is to zealously represent Ted and make him whole somehow from what he's going through.
That's why I asked. I felt like I've got two sons, and it sounds like a dad's worst nightmare for this to be happening, to know that your son is being sterilized. And on that subject, I've often wondered, you mentioned a detransitioner a moment ago, Ted. I've interviewed quite a few detransitioners. And one of the things I wonder is what does happen at age 25, 26, 27 later when they realize that they can never experience parenthood, sexual intimacy in many cases, because of decisions that were made before they were old enough to smoke or buy a beer or vote or drive. It's wild to consider what's unfolding. Just wild. Is there anything either of you would like to add? I really appreciate you taking all of this time and laying out the story. I think it's incredibly painful and very important. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well,
I think it would be really great if you could support Ted in his efforts. This he is fighting against how many attorneys, Ted?
We believe there's 26 attorneys combined facing Tracy and her very small team. You know, in the state and the federal actions, but it's not just the attorneys. We've got serious issues with judges who have already picked sides in this. Mm-hmm. And you know, I certainly hope that we get to discovery and we get to find out where the money went. Where did that $209,000 go? I know that I paid the minors counsel through this this ordeal. He earned about $20,000 directly in his billables. There's the former attorney for UCSF, Asaf Orr. What did any of this money get back to the family court, or is the game strictly just to put families into this system and drain us of our resources by fighting in family court?
And I think just to add to that, one of the things that's really interesting that people should realize, and a lot of people probably aren't even cluing into, is that all of our major institutions are being taken over by this ideology. When I go and renew my bar license, they ask me what my pronouns are. I walked into court for the first time. I passed the bar in 2007. I've been in the legal profession since 2002. For the first time in my career, I walked into court and some judge used his pronouns in Ted's case. That shows an implicit bias right there. Mm-hmm. We have a significant problem in the state of California with activist judges. So this is, and Ted, amazingly, at every step of the way, is fighting. So this is not an inexpensive endeavor, and he's not doing it by himself. So I would really encourage people to go to his GiveSendGo. And I would also encourage people, though, I am...
What should people Google to find the... We'll drop the link, but in addition, where's the GiveSendGo?
You can go to GiveSendGo, and in the search, if you simply put UCSF, it will come up. The URL is Stop Gender Experiments on Family Court Kid. You'll find it there.
And the other thing I would encourage, and Ted, you're going to have to jump in here, is that you come to the hearings virtually if you can, right? Most of our court appearances in the state of California are by Zoom. Sometimes we're going to go appear in person. And I'm not a huge fan of publicity unless it's beneficial, right? You know, obviously it has to be good for the client, in the client's best interest. It has to be something they want. And Ted has chosen that type of a path. And we put in a media request recently for Epoch Times to be able to come and record, and they denied it. So I think the publicity, from my perspective, scares the judge. And we filed a writ, and within less than 24 hours, we were granted a stay when he did some crazy things that Ted talked about earlier. So I think if you can come to the appearances in person or come to them via Zoom, I think that's a big deal in this case. And Ted, you can, I think you talk on a specific social media forum on how to do that.
I post updates on Give, Send, Go.
We can get them from there.
Yeah, you can get updates on the hearings. You can also find me a little bit on X. I'm not so active up there, but you can find me if you look. Tracy her organization, California Parents Union, is active on X. So sometimes she posts about this action as well as some similar ones, which she's found herself in her lap, I guess, lately.
Well, thank you both so much for taking all this time.
Thank you, Jonathan, for having me.
Thank you, Jonathan. Have a great day.
Ladies and gentlemen, that is my conversation with Ted Hudako and his attorney, Tracy Henderson. If you found this show enlightening, please do head over to lifesitenews.com, click on the podcast tab, and you can subscribe to get more of our shows there. We'll leave some links to let you know how you can help these people and other families just like them. Thanks so much for listening, and we hope you join us again next week.